World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Theater Council, presenting David Sedaris, author, humorist, and frequent contributor to NPR and This American Life, live at the Virginia Theater on Monday, April 18th at 8 p.m. Ticket information at 356-9063. Today's programming is made possible in part by the Beckman Institute for Advanced Science and Technology Open House, Friday, March 11th and Saturday, March 12th on the U of I campus. Exhibits include disco balls that make people disappear and flight simulators a child can use. The Beckman Cafe will also be open for meals, snacks, and beverages. More information is available at www.beckman.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inch. Glad to have you with us. Well, this winter, as winters go, has not been too bad here in central Illinois. At the same time, I think there are probably a lot of folks who are getting a little tired of it. And the idea of spring starts to sound pretty good. And in fact, it's not that far away. 10 days will be the first day of spring. And then things will start to warm up, and of course the days continue to get longer. One of the things, though, that we do have to look forward to as we move into spring and summer is the possibility of severe weather in the form of thunderstorms and tornadoes. And this is the time of year right around now when officials in the two states, Illinois and Indiana, set aside a time to encourage people to think about what they would do if a severe thunderstorm or a tornado was headed their way. And generally, about this time of year, we set aside a time to talk a little bit about severe weather, about the kind of that we get in the spring and the summer, and invite in our meteorologist, Ed Kieser, to talk a little bit about preparing for severe weather. And also, it's the opportunity if people have questions about weather forecasting and how the way the weather works, we can do that, too. This is about the only thing that we can't do, I think I probably should say, try to say when Ed is here in the studio. This is not like what we do on Fridays when it's talk to the meteorologist. We're not set up to do that now. We'll do it tomorrow just like we usually do it. And I think Mike Sola probably will be doing that. He'll be the guy because he's on in the mornings. So we can't do that. But other kinds of questions about weather, those we can take. And I know Ed will do his best to answer your question. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Well, it's good to be here. It just seems like the calendar keeps on moving, and here we are again.
That's right. It seems like it wasn't that long. We did one of these for
winter.
And here we are now talking about spring storms and tornadoes. Now, for the official Severe Weather Preparedness Week, I think we already had the one for Illinois.
Illinois was last week. Indiana is this week.
Okay, so we're at the right time. We're at the right time, and it's probably also worth reminding people that indeed, there can be severe weather different times of the year and can cause a lot of problems, but probably the most kinds of damage and risk to people does indeed come from things like thunderstorms and high winds and lightning and flash floods. I think, isn't it, flash floods is the, if you look at loss of life, that's the number one
of storm-related fatalities. Flash flood is number one, and lightning is number two, and tornadoes number three, so in that order. So we do talk a lot about tornadoes at this time of year because we are going into the high season for that, but all thunderstorms do pose a threat, especially with lightning, and those that do produce heavy rainfall can cause flash floods. And the flood season tends to last longer into the summer than the tornado season. That's not to say you can't have a tornado. In fact, we've had tornadoes every month of the year in Illinois and Indiana, but we do only get occasional tornadoes outside of the main tornado season, which starts in mid-March and runs through June.
And I guess maybe it's worth reminding people that that high winds can be very dangerous and can create a lot of damage. And certainly with a severe thunderstorm, you can have very high, you don't need to have a tornado to have high winds.
Exactly. A lot of wind damage from thunderstorms is from straight line winds, downburst winds of the like. And a lot of times those winds are over 100 miles per hour, which is high on the F1 into the F2 scale with tornado damage. So not all damage from thunderstorms is created by tornadoes.
Well, we have somebody who already has a question here, so let's go ahead and we'll talk with this listener, someone on the cell phone and on our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Do we have enough data over enough time to be able to find a trend in severe weather? I mean, you know, tracking it like versus sunspot cycles or something like that?
I don't think that severe weather tracks very well with something like sunspot cycles, in part because a lot of the raw numbers of the number of tornadoes in a year comes down to just a couple of key days. Now, last year and the year before, we had more key days than some of the prior years to that. But a lot of times it's just all the right ingredients coming together at once to produce a severe weather event. And a lot of that is much smaller scale than trying to find some big explanation. The larger scale features may help trend a season a little bit, but it just comes down to a lot of smaller scale features coming together at once. So I think a lot of times looking at sunspots, El Nino, or anything else of that ilk really doesn't give a good true answer. There's not a great correlation between severe weather and any one of those big things. They may be influenced. They do influence the big weather patterns a little bit, but it all comes. The nature of thunderstorms is of a smaller scale.
I was just suggesting those as possible. You know, as the types of things that we run into cycle events, 11-year cycles, that kind of thing. Do we have enough data? I mean, like from what I've seen. You know, when the country was populated and railroad lines and eventually telegraph lines, you know, are we recording data that, you know, how far back do we have reliable data and can we find trends with what data we do have?
Well, that's a good question in that if you look at the raw number of tornadoes per year, that's been on a steady increase in the United States. And a lot of that it seems to be attributable to the spreading out of the population and also the invention of the camcorder, which just about everybody has now. So a lot of little tornadoes that likely went undetected in the past are now being detected. So the number of tornadoes has gone up. Interestingly, though, the number of violent tornadoes, the F4 and F5 tornadoes, has not gone up at all over the last several decades. And that to me is indicative of probably what's really going on, and that is we're not seeing a trend up or down in the number of tornadoes overall. It's just the number that are detected has increased. But almost all of that increase has been on the weekend, the F0, the F1 end of tornado strength, which are usually the very short-lived tornadoes.
Thank you very much.
All right,
thanks.
Other questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The guest here on Focus 580, our chief meteorologist, Ed Kieser. We're talking about severe weather, the kinds generally we get in the spring and summer where we're talking about severe thunderstorms and tornadoes. And this is the time of year when we are encouraging people just to think about what would happen if a severe storm was headed their way. And just keep in mind some of the basic safety advice, how to take shelter, where to take shelter, and the fact that when there's a warning like that, you should really take it seriously because it can cause a lot of damage, and you want to make sure that you and your family are safe. As you have pointed out, I think that this past year, last year and the year before, there were large numbers of tornadoes reported, and maybe a little bump up in from what had been the previous average. I know how you feel about long-range projections. Are there people right now who are making some kind of statement about this spring and summer and saying, do they think that there will be as many, more, less?
I'm sure there's some people saying things, but really, going into the season, I don't think you ever really know for sure. The last couple of years, May has been a big month. May is the month that on average you have more tornadoes in Illinois and Indiana and nationally than any other month. We have had actually, though, the last several years, even with the high number of tornadoes, a relatively quiet early season. The March-April time frame has been quite quiet. Both of the last 2 years, the season really didn't get underway until May. So I think if there's any word of caution I would use, it is that sometimes in March and April, we do get outbreaks of storms, and sometimes they're quite violent. Some of the worst tornado outbreaks in history have occurred in March and April. So every year is a little bit different, and that's why we're doing the show now. I'd say the one thing that's been interesting over the last 2 years is really they were big years, but they both seasons started rather late.
Yeah. We have some callers here. Let me just do one other thing, because we here and a lot of other broadcast outlets try to give people information about storms, about when we say in this area today we think there's a chance of storm, so you want to be aware of that. And then there are times when we say there is a storm. Here it is. We've seen it. This is the direction it's moving. So watch out. But I think even as long as we've been doing that, there are people who are a little confused about watches and warnings. And we always want to say, okay, here's the deal. Which is which?
All right. We try to explain that as the situation occurs as well. And I think probably the confusion is because both words start with the letter W. I think that must be what it is. There's really actually a third stage to all this that's grown over the years. And there are what are called convective outlooks that are issued by the Storm Prediction Center every day, several times a day. And they look out, they have day one, day two, and day three. So today, tomorrow, and the next day on those outlooks. And sometimes we even talk about the potential for severe weather even farther down the road than that. Sometimes a severe weather event will occur rather quickly, but sometimes you can look at a weather pattern and know several days in advance that there's going to be trouble on that day. We don't know exactly what town, and sometimes not exactly what part of a state, but we know that, say, generally in the Midwest, there's going to be trouble in a few days. So we start to talk about that ahead of time. So that's your first sign that something may be coming. And then when it gets to where the conditions are ripe for storms to develop, then a watch is issued, either a tornado watch or a severe thunderstorm watch. Severe thunderstorm watches are issued when there will likely be severe thunderstorms, but not tornadoes. Those are usually issued for dozens of counties at a time, and that they're usually issued for no more than a 6-hour period, oftentimes less. And that means watch out. That means pay attention to the sky, listen to local media, your cable stations. Unless your cable company has a good cable override, your cable stations are not going to keep you updated. So it is your responsibility to take care of yourself when a watch is issued. And I think that's one thing. We can do a lot here to let you know the situation as far as severe weather, but nobody's going to come knocking on your door and say, hey, a tornado is coming down the street. So it is the responsibility for everybody to pay attention. And if there's one concern I've got out of the whole process is it seems a lot of people are becoming detached from reality out there, as there are more sources of radio and television and internet, and you still have to pay attention to something local during severe weather. So a watch means watch out, pay attention. A warning means that a tornado has been sighted or detected on radar. For a tornado warning, for a severe thunderstorm warning, that means damaging winds or large hail have been detected.
Okay. Well, let's talk with some more folks who are here listening. And next in line will be Urbana and line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
When you worry about a severe storm, you often mention that there are varying winds, winds in one direction at ground level, second direction higher up, that will form the basis of a twisting. What number of levels of I don't know what to call them, wind areas do you look for? I know I'm particularly interested in the jet stream level, because prediction on where the jet stream goes is really indicative for what sort of weather we will have here in Illinois. This current snowfall is associated with a jet stream bend that's going sort of straight down the middle of the continent and bringing Canadian air with it. So I'm wondering how, as a professional, how many layers of air you pay attention to.
Well, we try to look at the atmosphere as a whole in the area from the ground level up about 8 to 10 miles up. And the jet stream winds are strongest around 8 to 10 miles up in the atmosphere. So it's looking at the entire vertical profile of the atmosphere from the ground on up to that level. And as far as getting tornadoes, as you noted, a lot of times, well, most of the time, you do need a significant amount of wind shear, and that's a change of wind direction and speed with height. And the direction helps with the twisting, the directional change, and the wind speed change with height, with the winds faster as you get higher up, make for what we call a tilted updraft in a thunderstorm, because thunderstorms form with rising warm, moist air. But then once a thunderstorm is developed, the rain that falls cools some air and causes a what we call a downdraft or a downward flowing mass of air in the storm. And if the storm grows straight up, the downdraft will come down on top of the updraft and kill off the storm, which is what happens with most air mass or many call garden variety thunderstorms. But with the change of wind speed with height, that updraft gets tilted. So the downdraft doesn't come down on top of the updraft, so therefore you continue to feed warm, moist air in the storm, and it can continue to grow and maintain strength. So we do look at weather conditions from the ground on up through the troposphere, the lowest layer of the atmosphere, and the jet stream is at the top of that.
This always raises a question whenever I see a surface map with winds. Where does the wind go when you see air moving in one direction, hitting a boundary with another mass of air, which has winds in another direction? It's as though magically the air stops at that boundary. But in what direction does it go usually?
Well, if there's a boundary, such as a front, oftentimes a lot of the air is forced up. And rising air cools and condenses and makes clouds, and that's why you tend to have a lot of cloudiness around low-pressure centers and fronts. Fronts are attached to low pressure centers. So that's what we call a convergence of air. And when you have convergence of the surface, you have rising motion, rising air, which cools and condenses. And that's one of the lifting mechanisms we look for in the development of storms. Another way the air rises is just by what we call convection, when the atmosphere gets unstable. And that's just very warm air rising when the surrounding air is cooler. Similar to the mechanism for a hot air balloon rising. You add hot air inside a balloon to make it rise, because the air inside that balloon is hotter and less dense than the surrounding air. So convection is ultimately what builds a thunderstorm, but sometimes you need other lifting mechanisms, such as what we call frontal lifting, that convergence of air along a front to initiate the process of rising air.
Well, it'll be fun one day to see three-dimensional views of the weather instead of your usual flat information on the screen, but I'm sure that's coming. Thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you. And there are some scientists looking at three-dimensional views already. It is obviously complex technology, but I know here in the Beckman Institute, there have been 3D studies with some of the virtual reality rooms. I was in one several years ago where you could actually walk around a computer-simulated storm, and some research is being done in the three dimensions. But it's very difficult to just put that on anybody's computer, yeah, because obviously we have two-dimensional screens still.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with somebody else. Let's go to our line number 4. This caller's in Eureka. Hello.
Good morning. First of all, kudos to you, Ed, for your excellent reporting. It's, I think, of all media outlets, it's some of the best. The question or comment is, last night on the Weather Channel, they did a half-an-hour documentary on the Parsons tornado that struck near Roanoke, Illinois last July. I believe it was F4.
Yes.
On the scale. Did you see that, or do you have any comment on that particular one? It was just, I guess, so amazing, because to me, you only see things like that. I mean, it's tornadoes like that seem to be more on the in the plains, say, in Kansas, Oklahoma, or Texas. I'll get off the line and listen to your answer. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for your call, and thanks for the nice comments, too. what the gentleman's referring to is a tornado that hit near Roanoke, Illinois on July 13th last year, and at its maximum strength, it was an F4. And on Storm Stories on the Weather Channel last night, there was a profile on this particular storm, and I did not get to see the program, but have read up on this this particular event, and really it's an amazing and wonderful story. When you talk about storm stories, company named Parsons Manufacturing near Roanoke had 150 people in the factory at the time the tornado hit on July 13th, and the factory was destroyed. But this company had a plan ahead of time. They had three shelters built in their facility. Their plan included, of course, having the shelters, these rooms with steel-reinforced rooms with concrete and steel superstructure, if you will, tornado-safe rooms. So they had that built into the building. They conducted semi-annual tornado drills with the staff. Whenever a tornado threat occurred, whenever there was a watch, they would monitor NOAA weather radio in their front office. They would assign an individual to be the storm spotter for the company. Well, on this particular day, July 13th last year, tornado formed and started heading for the plant, and the spotter radioed in and said, "You got to get everybody to shelter." They all got to shelter. Not one injury. The factory was destroyed. It was an F4 tornado. Type of tornado that often kills people, and not even an injury there, 150 people. And so kudos to Parsons Manufacturing. I understand they are just now moving into their new building, and they now have 5 tornado safe rooms in there for their staff. But it was a classic case of planning ahead, and all of their planning paid off.
Great story. Let's talk to somebody else here. We'll go to Champagne. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi. Ed, I was at the storm presentation, your tornado show last year, and at one point you were talking about why this is Tornado Alley, and you had a graphic that showed wind directions at three different wind directions at different levels. And you said that caused a spiral of wind on the ground, horizontal. Now, thinking about the talk later, you pretty much answered all the questions that I had going in. And the thing I wish I had asked you after that talk is did you really mean to say that tornadoes start with a horizontal spin of air? And if so, how does it become vertical? And I'll hang up and let you comment on that. Thank you.
Okay, that is exactly what I meant. Oftentimes, when you have a tornado day, you'll have different wind directions with height. You'll have, in this part of the country, usually a southeasterly wind at the surface and more of a west-southwest to westerly wind aloft. That means winds near the ground are coming out of the southeast to south. The winds up at the jet stream level are coming out of the west or west-southwest. And the winds aloft are also stronger than they are at the surface. And what that does is, because you have weaker winds from a different direction at the ground level compared to aloft, you start to get this general large horizontal turning of the air. Now, what makes it go vertical is when you start to get convection. When thunderstorms start to build, that's just air that just starts to rise. It takes that horizontal, general horizontal spin and turns it vertically as warm air starts to rise, and what we call convection, when the atmosphere is very unstable. And then if that spinning motion concentrates itself, you'll get a decent rotating thunderstorm that could produce a tornado. So it's just taking a general, not easy to detect spin in the atmosphere in the horizontal, and turning some of the air, turning it vertically with rising air and concentrating that spin a little bit.
Okay. Other questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. We're about our midpoint here in this hour of Focus 580 with our chief meteorologist, Ed Kieser, talking a little bit about severe weather in the form of severe thunderstorms and tornadoes. This is the time of year when we're encouraging people to remember that these storms will come, and that it would be a good thing to just think about you know, as you're going through your daily life, think, well, what would I do if suddenly there was a severe thunderstorm warning or a tornado warning? What would I do? 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have another caller here, but maybe you want to take a couple seconds to give some of the basic safety guidelines in terms of just that last situation that I said. So if the sirens go off, if you know that there is a warning, that is, that's the one that says the storm is here, it's headed your way, what are the basic guidelines for the safest place to be?
Okay, if a storm is heading in your direction, there are two rules you should always remember if you're in a sturdy building, and you want to be in a sturdy building. That's the first thing. But the two rules to follow are go to the lowest floor possible and put as many walls between you and the outside or tornado as possible. So the lowest floor is the basement if you have one. If you don't have a basement, it's the first floor. You want to get as low as possible because tornado winds are stronger the higher up you go. Many tornadoes will just rip off higher floors of a house, for example. Now, the F4 and F5 tornadoes will get down to ground level, so that's why if you can get below ground, it is good to do that. The second part of the rule is put as many walls between you and the tornado or outside as possible. In the basement, you want to get under something sturdy. If you have a big piece of furniture or workbench, that's good. I always say getting under the staircase is a good place because you still could have debris fall on top of you if you're just out in the open. And unfortunately, in Utica, Illinois last year, some people were killed in the basement of a tavern because they were just in the middle of the basement and the tavern parts of it collapsed and some beams hit some people. So getting under something sturdy is important. If you don't have a basement and you're on the first floor, you want to get into a small room in the middle of the building or middle of the house. So if you have a bathroom or a closet in the middle of the house, that's a good place to be. You don't want to be near outside walls and certainly not near windows. If you happen to be caught outside, if you can get to a sturdy building, go there. If you can't, get into a low dip in the terrain, cover your head with your hands, lie flat, get as low as possible. Two places you do not want to be in when a tornado hits are mobile homes and motor vehicles. Mobile homes are absolutely the worst place to be in a tornado. About half of all tornado fatalities in the U.S. in the last decade have been to people inside mobile homes. Even F1 tornadoes can destroy a mobile home. Automobiles and cars and trucks are not much better, and you really don't want to be in one if that's hit by a tornado either, because they become flying missiles made of glass and metal, and don't even want to think about it.
Okay, very good. Well, let's talk with some other folks here. We have someone in Urbana. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi. Last summer when we had a tornado, I can never keep watches and warnings straight. I'm sorry. I should learn after being here for 30-some-odd years. But it pointed up to me, because we were dealing with visiting grandchildren, that it's important to enunciate. You know how kids get words confused? They thought it was a tomato alert. And little kids worry about things a lot, so we should be careful that we don't have kids thinking, getting confused about tomatoes. Something silly, but I just thought it would.
I don't think that was me. I think I enunciate tornado.
No, it was quite... the parents.
Yeah.
The parents,
oh, okay.
Probably. I'm just.
Oh, all right.
I'm telling parents that there could be some confusion for little kids who are just learning about this. So
you think they were just having a little fun?
No.
Or they were just.
Kids just hear. Words in songs and so forth that relate to what they know.
Okay.
This kid hadn't met a tornado before and thought we were saying tomato because we were taking cover and we're saying there was a tornado alert. He heard it as tomato.
Okay.
And was totally confused. And I didn't understand what the confusion was until he repeated it back to me.
Uh-huh. So these big flying red tomatoes were attacking, huh?
Oh, yeah, life for little kids is a complicated thing.
That's right. Well,
anyway,
if you grew up in a...
I'd add some levity to it.
All right. Well,
thanks.
I suppose if you grew up in a place where they didn't have tornadoes, you know, this would be something new. Just as here, we in this part of the country, we probably don't think a lot about hurricanes because you know, that's not something we have to worry about.
Well, you know, kids grow up with tomatoes, too. So they just, I can't think of anything offhand. But there were a few things when I was a child where something, I thought something was something else. And for the same reason, there was a similar sounding word. And I always wonder, well, what's the deal with that? And then when I got a little older, oh, that's a different word entirely. Yeah. Never mind. You know, it's like,
let's talk with someone else. Cell phone caller here, line number 4. Hello.
Hey, hello, how you doing?
Yeah, good.
Good, yeah. I just had a question. I grew up around the Plainfield area, and there was a tornado. It was either in 1990 or 91.
August.
I'm not exactly sure. And I believe it was an F5, and that some of the highest wind speeds in Illinois were recorded during that tornado. And I never hear anything really about that specific tornado on either the Weather Channel and Storm Stories or anything. And I just wondered if you knew anything about that tornado and if you could elaborate a little more on it, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Well, I know a bit about that tornado. I was working at WILL that day, and, of course, that's out of our primary severe weather coverage area. But we're putting some warnings from Northern Illinois on the air that day because it did look like an explosive storm. The storm hit on August 28th, 1990. It killed, I think, 29 people. It moved from northwest to southeast through a portion of Joliet, Crest Hill, and Plainfield. The maximum winds in that storm were given the F5 rating, which is the highest on the Fujita scale, which means the rotary winds within the tornado at its peak reached somewhere between 261 and 318 miles per hour. On average, there is less than one F5 tornado per year in the United States. Since 1950, there have only been two F5 tornadoes in Illinois, the other one being in December of 1957 in southern Illinois. Prior to that, there were likely some F5s, including the Tri-State Tornado of 1925. The Plainfield tornado was unusual in that it hit late in the season. In fact, I think since 1950, that's the only F5 in the month of August on record. Most F5s occur in March, April, and May. So an F5 in August is rare. It probably would be a good tornado for a Storm Stories type of show. The reason you probably don't hear much about it is there is no video that I know of that storm. And part of the reason for that is it did not have that classic funnel shape. This storm cloud approached from the northwest, and it was just a black cloud, and there was a lot of debris out ahead of it, and it didn't look like the classic tornado. Unfortunately, the other problem with it is the National Weather Service did not have a warning out for that storm. And I've thought that it was really highly unusual that there was no warning of any type out on that storm. At that time, there were the National Weather Service structure was different, but there were warnings out for tornadoes when storms the storm that ended up producing the Plainfield tornado moved through the Rockford jurisdiction. And then as soon as it crossed over into the Chicago National Weather Service jurisdiction, the warning stopped. And then some of the forecasters there were paying attention to a downburst near Aurora and missed that one. In their defense, I will say that nobody would have ever guessed that there would be an F5 tornado, but unfortunately, tragically, and it was probably one of the darkest days for the National Weather Service in Chicago, no warning was issued for Will County of any kind when that tornado first touched down, and the storm had a 60,000 foot top, and there really should have been one. And there were assessments of that later that came out, and it's all well documented what happened that day. So it was unfortunately not well warned on, but it was also a bit of a surprise in that it was as strong as it was, and also a bit of surprise to people just because it didn't have that classic tornado look to it. But it was an F5 at its peak.
You've now talked a couple times about the scale that rates the the severity of the storm. I guess that what they're talking about is the wind speed.
The rotary wind speed, and it's all the ratings. Whenever you hear somebody say, oh, that was an F3, an F4, F5, that would be the maximum wind speed in the tornado. So if a tornado travels 10 miles and is ranked an F4, that doesn't mean that all of the damage is F4. That just means the peak damage within the storm is F4. And the ranking goes from 0 to 5, and it's based on it's an estimate. There are all of the F numbers given are estimates based on the damage detected, because there's no good way to take specific measurements in a tornado for a couple reasons. One, you never know ahead of time where the tornado is going to go, and two, it'll blow away wind instruments, so you don't get a good measurement that way. So it is based on damage, and the problem with that, there's a couple problems. One, a person surveying the damage doesn't specifically know how well constructed buildings were. They got damaged or destroyed, so that could influence the number one way or another, and that's one major problem. Another is a lot of tornadoes, perhaps there are more F5 tornadoes that have occurred than have been rated F5, because if a tornado passes over a rural area and doesn't hit anything of significance, there's no real evidence of F5 damage. So that's another way which sometimes maybe a tornado gets underranked. I think a lot of times tornadoes are overranked, though. There was a case in Maryland a few years ago where a tornado hit La Plata, Maryland, near Washington, D.C., and instantly F5 was the number given, and that got knocked down to F4, and a lot of people I've talked to think it was only an F3. There was significant damage, but what happened was a building that wasn't well constructed got destroyed, and then the remains of the building got pushed down a ravine, so it just looked like catastrophic damage. But the bottom line in the end is you want to estimate the wind speed, and the wind speed on that storm probably was only in the F3 area, which is big for Maryland, mm-hmm. big for anyone, really. An F3 tornado is something you don't want to have hit your house, and we don't get a lot of those. Back in 1996, there were a few in central Illinois on April 19th, and Decatur, southeast Urbana, and Ogden. And anybody that lives in those areas knows the kind of damage that occurred, and F3 is a rather significant tornado, but F4 and F5, those are rare.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. That is what I remembered, that's what happens, is that only after the tornado is passed and the storm is over, people go back and they look at the damage and then they say, well, this looks to me like it would have been an F3 or an F4. It's not the case that there's no way to, with scientific instruments, twister aside, that that you could actually get into a tornado and measure what was going on.
And that's interesting. You bring up Twister. Any of the tornado movies you see out there, you'll see the actor saying, "Oh, there's an F5," or "Look at that," or some will look at the radar. Well, we got F4s and F5s coming, and you can't look at a tornado and say that's an F4 or that's an F5. You can look at a tornado and say, well, that looks strong or violent versus a weak one, because the rotation is extremely strong on it. You can maybe get somewhat of an estimate on it, but nobody knows for sure until later. And mm-hmm. you certainly can't look at a radar and say, that's an F5 or that's an F3. So whenever you see that in the movies, that's just the movies.
Well, now, because of the kinds of radars that we have now, we get better kind of pictures of the storms than we did before. Is the big thing now that you can actually see the directions of the winds and you can actually see whether there is rotation, and you can see that on radar?
Doppler radar can detect rotation in many storms. But the radar beam, the Doppler effect, only helps us in seeing winds going away from or toward the radar, and by knowing that, we can infer where there's rotation. But unless the radar beam is lined up just right with a storm, you can't detect the exact wind speed in the storm. So there are some limitations there. Also, farther away from a radar site you get, the higher up into a cloud the radar beam is looking. So the detection of mesocyclones, that's the small area of rotation from which a tornado comes from in a thunderstorm. The higher up you get into a cloud, the less you can detect that. So the farther away from a radar site you get, the less chance the radar will have of detecting a tornado. So the bottom line here is that Doppler radar certainly has helped us greatly in detecting tornadoes, but Doppler radar does not detect all tornadoes, and that's why counties still have volunteer severe weather storm spotters that go out. They are very, very important. The role of a storm spotter has not been diminished at all because of newer technology. In fact, basically the radar sometimes just helps us say, we think there's a problem here, and the storm spotters in the area are then asked to confirm what they see. So radar helps, but it certainly doesn't tell us everything.
All right, let's talk with someone else here. We have a Champagne caller, line number one. Hello.
Hi, what can you tell me about helping kids deal with the anxiety that they experience when storms are approaching?
Well, I'm not a psychologist, so I am probably not the best person to comment fully on this. I can just say I think the thing to do is just be reassuring and not try to induce panic. If probably one thing to do in your home is to practice ahead of time. Maybe have your own tornado drill and let your family know where to go if you have to go quickly. Because that's one thing, if a tornado approaches, there's not a lot of time to react most of the time. So you need to know ahead of time where you're going to go. And I think just a little bit of familiarity with that would help during a storm situation. Because then they'll be focused on what they are to do and do it. And I know children are often very, very welcome to the idea of practicing such things as where to go for a tornado. I think they like to know that there's a plan in place. So that's one thing I can suggest, and I think just as an adult to try to remain calm, even though I'm sure you would be terrified if a tornado, I know I would be. You know, that's one of those things, and if a tornado actually does hit, you know, there's not much you can do then as far as anxiety. But on just the routine storms, I'd say just being informed and doing the just remaining calm are the best anybody can do, really. I know I feel I personally feel better when I know what's going on. Even if I don't like the news, I still rather know what's going on than have no idea what's going on.
But, right. Okay.
And that's what we try to do here at WILL, is tell you what's going on as best we can.
Here is always where we tune when there's weather approaching. So, okay.
All right. Well, thank you.
And I'm sure psychologists have other ideas, too, on how to handle fears and anxieties that children have. So I don't want to go too far into that area because I'm not an expert, but...
Well, I think that the advice you gave was pretty good because I think that, you know, that's one of the things we talk about at this time of year. We suggest that families ought to have a plan in case something happens so that everybody knows, okay, if it happens, what do we do? Where do we go in the house? Are there certain things that we should have? You know, is somebody in charge of making sure that they have the pets? Somebody in charge of making sure that they have a flashlight and a battery-operated radio and, you know, all those sorts of things.
And shoes.
This is where we're going to... Well,
and I bring that up because a lot of people I've talked to that have lived through tornadoes say, I don't know, I usually wear shoes. Apparently a lot of people don't at home, and it seems a lot of people end up not wearing shoes when a tornado hits. And some have even told me, keep a pair of shoes where you go in your shelter. Because one thing, if a tornado hits, you're going to have a lot of debris on the ground.
Yeah.
And that's just something people have told me that have lived through tornadoes.
No, I think, you know, making sure that they know that they're they're prepared. They know what they're supposed to do. They know where to go. Maybe everybody has a little job as their thing to do. I think that's probably pretty good. All right. Well, let's go to Kingman, Indiana. This is line number four for someone
Hello.
Else. Hi.
Hi.
I've heard several people, including yourself just a little while ago, say that a mobile home is the absolute worst place to be in a tornado.
Yes.
We have a new mobile home, and it's got Florida hurricane-strength tie-down straps and really no other place to go except the ravine beside the house. We're kind of sheltered behind a low hill that's about as tall as the house is. And I feel pretty safe and secure here, but you know, listening to you today, I'm questioning my sanity.
Well, I could tell you, I don't know a whole lot about Florida hurricane tie-down straps. I would that probably improves your odds a little bit, but still, maybe it could withstand straight-line winds a little more than a typical mobile home, but we've found that even F1 strength winds, when most tornadoes are F1, they'll cause damage to sturdy buildings but not destroy them. So people are usually pretty safe in a sturdy building, but we've seen that F1 strength winds actually destroy a lot of mobile homes. So maybe you have a better than average mobile home there, but I still would not be a fan of being in that in a tornado.
Yeah, I'm more worried about the large trees around us than I am about the house itself. Steel frame and tie-down straps into cement in the ground. It feels pretty sturdy, but, of course, a tornado is a tornado.
Yeah, well, certainly if you got to a strong or violent tornado, I don't think tie-down straps would help much. Probably what it will help you with are your more typical damaging thunderstorm winds. It might keep your mobile home together better than the average one. But I do know that in Florida, I don't think they recommend people staying in a mobile home during a hurricane either.
No, but with a hurricane, you have more warning than with a tornado.
Exactly.
So if the tornado comes over the horizon and you were me in my house with my kids, would you stay in my house or would you head for the ravine?
Well, if it's a big tornado, I'd probably still head for the ravine, even though that it seems counterintuitive to go outside. But I would also, if it's a high threat day, I would go somewhere else for that day. I'd probably go to a place that, ahead of time before any storms hit. If it's one of those high threat storm days, you should probably just go to where. You're going to be a little safer. And obviously, your odds of ever being hit by a tornado are small, so you could do that for years on end and nothing happens. You may think it's silly, but unfortunately, I heard a story from Piatt County, Illinois, a few years ago. Some people living north of Cisco lived in a mobile home, and they would go into town every time there's a tornado watch or storms approaching. And there's one night when they said, it's 9 o'clock at night or so. I don't feel like going in. I got hit.
Yeah.
And one of the people was killed, so.
Well, I kind of get fatalistic and think when it's my time to go, it's my time to go, and there's not much I can do to prevent that.
Well, that's true. And, you know, people could do all the right things and still the twist of fate could go against them, and it's all random. All I can say is, statistically, in the last decade, about half of all people killed in tornadoes in the U.S. have been in mobile homes, which I find to just be a startling statistic, because I know the population in mobile homes is a lot less than 50%. I think we looked one year and it was around 17% of the population or so, somewhere in the teens.
Are you familiar with the tornado that hit Xenia, Ohio in 74?
Yep, April.
I was there the next day.
Ooh.
My aunt and uncle lived there in Xenia with my cousins, and so my grandfather and my parents and my brothers and sisters and I, you know, grabbed the rakes and the shovels and the bottled water and the blankets and everything we could lay our hands on, and that's how we got through the National Guard security post that had shut down all of the entrances. Route 35 goes into Xenia, and that's the way we went in. And I will never forget seeing semi-trucks twisted like, I don't know, some tin foil toy laying on top of telephone poles, laying on top of the Kroll's, I don't know, the people that make the faucets. It mm-hmm. was awful. I remember seeing 150-year-old buildings, and the only thing that was left was the bathroom on the second floor and the plumbing going down to the basement. It was horrible. I mean, the stories of what happened to the people, I think there were 35 or 36 people that died in that storm.
It was in the 30s.
There were people found in unusual places, inside signs.
It was
a horrible thing. I'll never forget it, and I've been terrified of tornadoes ever since. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thanks for your call. I went through Xenia about a month and a half after that, and was still had an impression on me. Obviously, you don't clean something like that up in a month. It was really a horrifying experience for the people there, and it's still scarred some 31 years later. Anytime the tornado sirens go off in Xenia, there's a little bit more panic than in most places, even though that's now a generation ago that happened. And that was an F5 during the super outbreak of tornadoes, the worst outbreak in U.S. history, on April 3rd of 1974.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. We just will give you our promise that we'll do our best to keep you informed of the weather so you can tune here. And also, it's as we've said, it's a good idea to just give some thought to what you would do if a storm was headed your way, and have some sense of what the basic advice is, and keep your heads down, and we'll do our best to keep you up on what's going on. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Well, my pleasure.
Ed Kieser is our chief meteorologist here at AM 580. Programming on the station made possible by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. The broadcast is also made possible by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway piano showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. On the next Afternoon Magazine, you'll hear a true story that is stranger than fiction. We'll look into the transformation of Lev Nussbaum. He transformed himself from a Jew to a Muslim prince and became a best-selling author in Nazi Germany. Tom Reese is the author of a book that tells the story. It's The Orientalist, Solving the Mystery of a Strange and Dangerous Life. He'll be talking with Celeste Quinn during the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine today. A little later on here, on a second hour of our show, we'll be talking with Ann Forst about her book, God in the Machine, What Robots Teach Us About Humanity and God. She is both interested in high technology and in theology, and will talk with us in the next part of the show. First, though, we'll break for an update on the markets, so stay tuned.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, working with the American farmer, creating products from his crops, creating markets for